Thank you, Rob, and I hope you're enjoying all this. There's a lot to take in this elaborate convention here. I have no relationships to disclose, and certainly no conflictual relationships. So I came at this work as a clinical psychiatrist from my very first patient who hung himself in the hospital while he was on a suicide watch. I was a first-year resident back in 1972. Fortunately, he was saved. But when I went to and he had no physical sequelae, and when I went to talk with him, he said, I think I've been a bad patient. And I assured him that he was not, but in the back of my mind I said, had I been a bad doctor? How did this happen? And virtually every clinical activity that I have done was stimulated by that experience. I worked at the Cambridge Hospital Emergency Room. We had, over 10 years, we had 4,000 emergencies a year, one suicide attempt a day. And as I began to work with patients, let colleagues know that I'm willing to work with suicidal patients, and I began to teach about it. And I really wondered, what is it really like to feel suicidal? And we've all had the experience of feeling down, but I came across a quote in an editorial in the New York Times, and I think this really describes it, this inextinguishable anguish. And if you think about treatment, one of our goals is to lower that flame. There's no, as Richard says, there's no simple way to do that. So we now have a lot of technology, a lot of apps, and how do we keep the focus on the person in front of us to establish an alliance, to take a very careful and complete history, understand the person sitting in front of you, to demonstrate empathy, and to have, but also, and to think about it, you can't ski unless you know how to stop and start. To understand suicide assessment, you have to know the underpinnings of suicide, and that's part of what we need to teach colleagues and the public. But Richard said a very important thing about looking at the person in front of you. And yes, I was trained on Freudian dynamics, and here's a famous quote of his: "When I set myself the task of bringing to light what human beings keep hidden within them, not by the compelling power of hypnosis, but by observing what they say and they show, I thought the task was a harder one than it really is. He that has eyes and ears to hear may convince himself that no mortal can keep a secret. If his lips are silent, he chatters with his fingertips. Betrayal oozes out of him at every pore, and thus the task of making conscious the most hidden recesses of the mind is one which is quite possible to accomplish." I highlight this because, in a sense, this emphasizes what Richard is saying. When you're doing a suicide assessment, whether you have the app in front of you or you have to look at that person, how they respond, do their in terms of furrowing their brow, do they look away? Very, very important, and not to be forgotten. So the suicide assessment protocol that I developed, and this is a work in progress that I started in 1972 in my work in the Cambridge and to the work in the guidelines, has five elements: to identify risk factors, protective factors. This third is really, I think, a very underappreciated aspect of what we do, and that's to conduct a suicide inquiry. And you know, in the charts that you, for those of you who get to see read charts, it says either a circle with a line through it, no SI or no plan. But these are very detailed questions that you need to ask, because it gives you a sense as to how serious the person is contemplating suicide. And you determine the level of risk based upon these three steps, and then documentation, which is I see Mort here. Mort and I have done medical legal work over the years, and I've probably reviewed over 1,000 cases in my career. And I can tell you, documentation is one of the serious weaknesses in our field. And it's not just for medical legal purposes, but it forces you to determine what direction you want to take with the person in front of you. And when do we do a suicide assessment? It should be done at every first contact, every initial examination of a patient, client, any subsequent suicidal behavior, any increased ideation, when there's a pertinent clinical change, particularly loss, or prior to increasing privileges or discharge if one is working in inpatient settings. So what do we know, and this is obviously not an inclusive list, but the basic elements, 90 to 95% have psychiatric illness. The gender distribution, 80% are males, so with the exception over the age of 85, it probably rises to 90%. It's reversed for suicide attempts, and this is the problem that we have today, and it's, Richard and his group are working, and we all are, on suicide prevention. 60% of completions are on the first attempt. 50% have never had psychiatric contact, and only 25% are in active mental health treatment. But here's another finding that, and this was actually noted in the first psychological autopsy studies done by Lee Robbins at Washington University in St. Louis. 77% of people communicate intention to significant other. We have to use that when we're talking with families, because doing a lot of public speaking that I do, unfortunately, a response that people say when they hurt a loved one is thinking about suicide, they will say, "We love you. Don't think about that. Tomorrow is another day." We have to teach the public that talking about suicide, thinking about suicide, should be treated in the same vein as someone who's having chest pain or choking, to think of it as a medical emergency and get that person to help. This figure today, 5% of suicides occur in hospital settings, and this, of course, is it's sobering, and it certainly impresses upon us both the seriousness of mental illness and what we can do to really take care of the most seriously ill patients. Now, these are some alarming trends, and Richard and I were talking about this at lunch today. Over the past 10 years, there's been a 25% increase in the general population, almost 10% in the young people, and this group, 45 to 54, and I suppose it's one of the good things about getting a little bit older, you pass that age group, but and then we all know about the military. Is there an explanation? There certainly is not one explanation. We can look to the economy, substance abuse, marital status, but this is the work. This is, in some sense, why we're here, why we're doing mobile apps. There's a lot of work that needs to be done in this area. So this is a broad brush of the risk factors for suicide, and at the heart is psychiatric illness and comorbidity, substance use and abuse. 25 to 50% of all persons who commit suicide have alcohol in their blood. The role of personality disorders, severe medical illness, particularly the phenomena of chronic pain and disfigurement, and we need to pay attention to that. I won't go into neurobiology, but certainly our understanding in that field is very important as we try to address our therapeutics, and I'll talk about specific symptomatology. Family history, yes, there is a genetic predisposition to suicide, and we need to be asking about that. And to understand the psychodynamics is still very, very important in terms of people's connections, their self-esteem, and their vulnerability, and past suicidal behaviors. And this is, you know, the life stressors. When you start out as a medical student, you're taught when you're doing a medical history, why now? Why now? And that's what you're really trying to understand with the life stressors and access to weapons, which I'll talk about. So I'm only going to talk about in terms of this major psychiatric disorders, and of course the top three are mood disorders, the psychoses and schizophrenia, and your substance abuse and alcoholism. 60-70% of all suicides are by persons with affective disorders. And the reason I started National Depression Screening Day is to get those people into treatment. In 1991, about 30% of people with depression received treatment. As of 2008, over 50%. Now you can say that's a dramatic increase, but look at how many people still are not getting treatment, and it's anywhere from 6 to 7 million people. And so to be able to pay attention to that, the notion of anxiety and panic, moderate alcohol abuse, bipolar disorder is the only disorder that at least I'm aware of in which the risk for suicide is the same as in men and women. And the issue of loss here. So the key symptoms, again, not an exhaustive list, but particularly hopelessness, and an underappreciated symptom is global insomnia. Certainly we try to address that, but certainly when you're taking a history to ask a person about their sleep, because try to imagine what is it like to feel depressed, have hopeless thoughts, and to be awake all night. That is why 72% of suicides occur in the early morning. And talked about family history. The issue of asking about a weapon. Whether or not a person has a plan, if they have suicidal ideation, whether or not it's passive or active, to ask about a firearm. That 55-60% of all suicides are by firearms. For adolescents, it is an independent risk factor, and you need to document that and to basically figure out a way to either restrict access or remove that firearm. The issue of protective factors, and a way of thinking about it is, what are the pillars that are holding a person up? Having children in the home, religiosity, which is a neglected part of our psychiatric and psychological examination. And it's not so much the type of religion, and yes, I could point you to statistics that show differences, but it's whether or not religion is a resource for the person and how to get that person back to religion in terms of having reality testing ability and support systems. And certainly in the work with our more ill patients, is the support system the problem or the solution, and it's your job to figure that out. And having a positive therapeutic relationship, and the issue of resiliency, which has been bandied about, but I think it's very, very important how we try to teach it and develop it. We struggle with that, but if you think of resiliency as a positive outcome in the face of adversity, and you look for what are the qualities, and it's really, we can look to the Japanese who, in dealing with their tsunamis, that what they are able to do is to recognize the recognition of one's unique path and the acceptance of one's life. What's important about that is that it's not resignation, but it's not focused on the why me. It's say, this has happened, and what can I do about it, and where do I go for help? Not an easy thing to do, and having watched the Roosevelt series on PBS, I was struck by what Eleanor Roosevelt said. You have to accept whatever comes, and the only important thing is that you meet it with courage and with the best you have to give. Now, we work with persons who need our support to do that. And part is to recognize the extra efforts they may need at certain times to get them through that. Now, what are the different definitions that were established by the Columbia Group in terms of completed suicide? And the key word here is where there is at least some intent to die. Suicide attempt, which is potentially self-injurious behavior, again, with intent to die. And then the preparatory acts, which again are important to recognize when you're asking, particularly in terms of what we call aborted. Did the person start to hurt themselves but stop? Or did they start to hurt themselves and they were interrupted? If you only ask a person, have you hurt yourself, you will miss this. So you want to ask, have you tried to hurt yourself? Maybe nothing happened. So you want to know, did they drive to a bridge? Did they play with a noose? Did they take a gun out? And then suicidal ideation are both passive and active thoughts about wanting to die. And so when you're doing, so now we've done the first step, risk factors, protective factors, and this specific suicide inquiry, you want to begin with asking questions about their feelings about living. Have you ever felt so bad that you wanted to die? Have you ever thought about ways that you would further that idea? And then you can go into different acts that they may have taken. But the key word here is intent. So that's why, you know, when I teach and used to teach the residents in the emergency room, just because someone took 6 aspirin, that didn't mean they were not suicidal. You want to know what was their intent, what was their knowledge, because for some people, 6 aspirin could be lethal, even though we know medically it's not. You want to ask them about what is their worst episode of suicidal ideation, and this comes from the work of Aaron Beck at Penn, because it gives you a sense as to how bad someone can be. And then you, for psychotic persons, you want to obviously ask about hallucinations and delusions, particularly command hallucinations, and then the specific methods. Are they reversible in terms of pills, or are they irreversible in terms of hanging, firearms, jumping? And it's hard to talk with someone about that, but it's, I think Richard made the point, it's not only a relief, but it's also establishing a connection with someone who, in this suicidal state, feels that they're unreachable. And you do want to ask about violence toward others, and again, it's studies are very weak in this area, but we think about 10 to 15% of all suicidal persons will also have homicidal. I'm going to skip about plan, but here's an important finding. Jan Foster and I looked at 76 inpatient suicides, and 77% of persons denied suicidal ideation as their last communication. So when someone denies suicidal ideation, you have to ask yourself, does it make sense? Does it go along with the rest of their symptoms? And sometimes you may want to challenge them. And yes, it's one of the harder things that we have to do because most people who deny it are denying it, but some people who deny it still have it, and that's a clinical challenge, and that's, again, to emphasize Rob's point about getting to the person. Your assessment of risk is basically taking the 3 steps and coming up with a risk level. Our current levels are high, moderate, and low, and you can have one risk factor and be acutely suicidal, and you can have multiple risk factors and not be suicidal, and that's also one of the problems. And I know There's been a Columbia scale and coming up with a score, but that's really based on looking at the lethality of the attempt and persistent ideation and behavior. And then the issue of documentation, to document the risk level, your treatment plan to address or reduce the risk, firearm instructions if relevant, and then a follow-up plan. And again, you do have privacy considerations. You want to include a significant other, and this is both available and it may require a breach of confidentiality, and that's a clinical judgment. If you feel you need to talk with a significant other because you are concerned about the safety of the person in front of you, and since I can just tell you what I do, I absolutely call the other. And it is, in my view, is the quintessential clinical judgment. You want to determine a safe treatment setting that's responsive to the risk level, and you absolutely want to preserve the therapeutic relationship. So I'm getting the signal to stop, and I will stop there. Thank you.